Thanks very much, Bill. When Bill invited me to give this talk, he said, "Oh, at 7:30 it's enough." I said, "Oh, I presume you mean 7:30 p.m. He said, "No, no, a.m. As Rosemary Buckingham will attest, I'm not a morning person, so I'm not in my natural habitat here, so forgive me if I ramble a little bit. I wrote World Vision's climate change policy, so I was heavily involved. I've been immersed in that for the last year, and then went to Bali on the Australian government delegation as one of the NGO representatives. But as I was looking more and more at climate change, you can't look for too long at climate change before you start looking at energy, and you can't look for too long at energy before you realise there's another whole issue around oil and their energy futures, which is a problem in its own right without even climate change being a part of it. So I want to talk about both of those things and giving a bit of a Christian reflection. I'm going to do not a great deal on the Christian reflection, because I think you guys are all plenty capable of doing that, and Peter's, I'm sure, taught you very well over the last 7 years. But I will touch on that and then draw out some questions at the end. If people have burning questions as I go through, feel free to ask. This is a slide from the American paper USA Today from January in Haiti, saying Haiti's poor resort to eating dirt. And the poor in Haiti have a traditional kind of backstop when nothing's working or all their crops have failed. They go and get this clay and then mix some vegetable shortening with it and a bit of salt, and they bake it in the sun and then they eat it. Not good for you, but it fills up the stomachs for a while. And so they've been doing that. You may have read more recently, this is from January, more recently there have been food riots in Haiti and Cameroon and Egypt and Morocco and a whole bunch of places around the world where food prices have just gone through the roof. And so this, I'll return to food a couple of times as we go through this, because both the climate change and the oil issue impact on this. Just a very brief overview of the mechanism of greenhouse effects. I mean, it's kind of a fairly familiar term, but a lot of people may not realise how it actually works. I mean, basically the sun's energy comes in at a certain wavelengths, and a lot gets bounced off the Earth, particularly off the polar ice caps and so on. They're all white, so all the snowy bits reflect most of the heat straight back. But the heat, when the light that's absorbed is heat, when it's radiated back, it's a different wavelength. So the infrared radiation coming back, a lot of it gets absorbed by the atmosphere and the greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, so it has a kind of this blanketing effect. If that effect just didn't exist, we'd be freezing cold, we wouldn't be here. So we owe our existence to the greenhouse effect in one sense. That makes our world habitable. But the problem is that there's too much going in the atmosphere now, and so this mechanism is keeping too much heat in. Now, this is a nice slide with lots of photos. The next one, I'll just warn you, is a graph with lots of charts and squiggles. So some people don't like that, some people do. So I'll just warn you, there's photos and there's graphs in this presentation to cater for everyone. But there's been a lot of studies done on the ice cores in both Antarctica and Greenland. They drilled down sort of a couple of kilometres or 2 or 3 kilometres through the ice. They drill up, bring up these cores, sort of around this size. And from that, they can basically map right the way through the whole column of ice, the different snow layers, the annual snow layers, and count back kind of 400,000 years. And what that's shown us is this picture. Now, this is about as technical as it gets, so don't worry. Don't be alarmed if this misses you, but if you like this, great. Well, the top line show, the blue one, is carbon dioxide concentrations for the last 400,000 years. The right-hand side of the scale is just 100 years, so that's why it's a different shape. But back right to 400,000 years, we know the carbon dioxide concentrations and methane, the green one, that's the gas that comes out of rotting garbage and cows and so on, and natural gas, of course, is methane. Both those gases and temperature track each other very, very, very closely for the last 400,000 years. Temperature is the bottom one in the red. The dips right at the bottoms are the ice ages. So basically when it gets really low, that's when you've kind of got a mile of ice over your house if you're in England or Germany or something. So we know that these temperatures track each other very closely. The last 100 years, we can see that we have shot carbon dioxide and methane totally off the scale. Anything that the Earth's seen in the last 400,000 years, and actually if you go back further, about a million years. So we are pushing the atmosphere beyond anything it's seen for hundreds of thousands of years. Arctic sea ice, this is just a trajectory from 1980 to 2007. I think that shot is from 2003 roughly, but the chart, you can see the sea ice sort of melts annually around August, September up in the Arctic, and it's been progressively melting more and more and more and more and more. And last year's melt season was the highest on record and opened up the Northwest Passage around Canada and Russia and so on. So now, kind of ironically, there's this mad scramble for oil and minerals and so on under the Arctic Ocean. The Russians went and planted a titanium flag under the North Pole and said that's ours, a little mini sub out there. So there's this big kind of resource, you know, manoeuvring going around up in the Arctic Ocean as the sea ice retreats. It's also opening up exploration fields in northern Canada for minerals and oil that were not previously accessible. Now the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that's IPCC, had this. They're a group of, you know, a couple of thousand scientists represented from around the world who put out these big global assessment reports every sort of 3 to 5 years, roughly every about 5 years. Their major report came out again last year in three big volumes and summary reports and then synthesis reports of policymakers. It finally gets down to about the summary of the synthesis report's about 10 pages or so. If you want to just get the very essence of what they're saying, you can read that. If you want to go into it more, there's about 10,000 pages. But their conclusion is that it's on. This is really happening. This is not a drill. This is real. And it's unequivocal. It's not really any debate that it's going on. What this chart shows very simply is the blue bands are running the climate models that we've got. I should say it's not all, the evidence doesn't all come from models. The evidence comes from observations all around the world of actual changes on the ground. But just looking at the models at the moment, if you run the models just including natural events like, you know, solar radiation, normal heating and stuff, and take out any influence from human gases, you get the blue band of what the models would predict was going on. If you actually include the human influences, in climate change, greenhouse gases, then you get the pink bands. And what the black lines through the middle of the pink bands show, the black line is observations of what we've seen happen since about 1900. And the observations do not match the models unless you put human influence in them. So what that's telling us is that we are having a real effect on the climate, and that matches, our observations match that pretty closely across all those different regions. So in every region of the world, temperatures have been going up, and the only way to explain that is our influence. So what, this couple of slides is a little bit depressing, so bear with me, but the conclusions and projections from the IPCC are very stark. What they've said is that our global atmospheric concentrations have increased from about 280 parts per million of carbon dioxide to 379 million. So we have pushed that, you know, off the scale, as the first chart showed. They concluded the warming. These are all quotes from the IPCC, by the way. They said the warming of the climate system is unequivocal. There's no debate that it's warming. 11 of the last 12 years were about the 12 warmest years on record since about 1850. The sea levels have been rising, about 1.8 millimetres per year between 61 and 2003, but the rate was faster from 93 to 2003, about three times as fast. So sea levels are rising and the pace of rising is accelerating. And they have risen about 17 centimetres in the 20th century. What they also pointed out strongly, which did not come out in the media reports, is that the ice sheet dynamics are not well modelled at the moment. So what the current models and what they used to think happened with ice sheets is basically like, you know, if I've got a great big lump of ice on this table, you know, it would kind of melt from the top down and, you know, gradually sort of turn to water. What they know now, as I will show in a couple of minutes, is that the ice sheets don't work like that. And, you know, cracks change everything. And a lot of the scientists are now quite worried the ice sheets are much more unstable and dynamic than they thought they were originally. And that suggests that their estimates for sea level rise were very conservative, underestimates at best. So their conclusions also is that drought areas will increase in extent. The projections for southern Australia, for southwestern Australia and for our southern wheat belts are pretty terrible. But also heavy rain events increase in frequency. So the same area may get roughly the same amount of rainfall, but it'll be concentrated in droughts and torrential rains rather than necessarily being even. Also, about a sixth of the world's population relies for their water on meltwater from the glaciers, and they are retreating in the Himalayas and pretty much everywhere else. But also, even a 1.5 to 2.5 degree temperature rise puts about 20 to 30% of all plant and animal species at risk of extinction. So this is setting up one of the biggest extinction events in history, potentially, if we don't rein this in. They also project that millions more people flooded each year due to sea level rise. And that's not just permanent inundation, it's the storm surges you get that can make land completely uninhabitable. You're going to get wiped out by storm surges every year or two. You don't bother rebuilding unless you're really poor and you have to. But for Africa, they're projecting between 75 and 250 million people short of water by 2020, and in Asia, up to 1 billion people short of water by 2050. This is what I was talking about with the ice sheets. This is a moulon from Greenland, which is basically these crevasses in the ice. When the ice starts to melt, it forms these big pools of meltwater on the surface, and that absorbs more heat because it's not white, it's darker blue, and it absorbs more heat. And so you get this feedback effect where it's dark, absorbs more heat, and melts more, and absorbs more heat, and melts more. So, but these fissures change everything because what they think is that basically these things go right to the base of the ice sheet and they help to lubricate the bottom of it. So that's one of the mechanisms that we've seen why some of these huge Antarctic ice sheets have broken off over the last 10 years, a couple of them. Now, thankfully, they're ones that are floating already, so they don't actually change sea level. But the ones that... What's happened, though, is it's accelerating the glaciers coming off the Antarctic ice sheets into the sea, and that does increase sea level. Don't worry about the details of this. I just wanted to show you this table. What World Bank did an analysis, and they said, what would be the effects of a 1 metre sea level rise, which is entirely within the realms of possibility of the century? They said, it would, even a 1 metre sea level rise would affect 56 million people around the world. And we do not, our systems would not cope with that. Humanitarian systems, our political systems would not cope with, mass movement of, 50, 60 million people. Don't worry about the detail of this either. I just want to show you a diagram. This is our attempts. People can say to us, World Vision, you guys are a development agency. What are you doing? What are you doing with climate change? Why are you interested in that? And they said, this is why. Bang. And if we can do it in one diagram, this is kind of a summary, but I'll take you through it. The sources of emissions are at the top. And so we know they're from industrial processes, heating, electricity generation, transport. So all the and agriculture, all these things that we rely on for our industrial economy relies on. But also deforestation and forest fires and contribute to it. In 1998, I don't know if you remember, but Indonesia's forests burned for months and months, and you could see the smoke from space, and everything is quite horrific. And this is one of the problems: the rainforests dry out, and then they burn, and they dry out more, and they burn more. So this is something that scientists are very worried about if you get another one of these feedback effects. But also thawing permafrost in the Arctic, Canada, and northern Russia, and so on. That is holding a lot of carbon dioxide and methane. As it thaws, it rots, releases carbon dioxide and more methane, and so that contributes to the problem as well. So there actually gets a point where if you warm the world up enough, the biosphere becomes a net contributor of carbon dioxide to the atmosphere. So it's not just us anymore making the problem. We push it too far, and then we've got nature joining in, releasing more gas as well, and that's when we've kind of lost it. The primary impacts through these natural areas, like on the more frequent and severe droughts, more frequent severe floods, frequent severe heat waves. The one in Europe in 2003 killed about 30,000 people, I think, from memory. More frequent severe tropical storms as well, but also on the far right, loss of biodiversity and keystone species. In ecosystems, you can have particular species which are like a link in a chain. If you take out that species, it can affect the entire network and the whole ecosystem can be irrevocably changed or can actually collapse. So having a projection of sort of 20 to 30% of the world's species at risk of extinction is no small matter. It's not like, you know, there's going to be a whole bunch of bugs that we don't care about. You know, it can actually be some really significant species that affect whole ecosystems. But the dryings and the lightning and the storms and so on contribute to more frequent severe forest fires and bushfires for us. The droughts and so on contribute to crop failures and collapsing rangelands. The acidification of the oceans as well means that as the oceans absorb more carbon dioxide, they produce more carbonic acid, and that means that little sea critters and shellfish and so on have more trouble making shells and all kinds of stuff. So that affects them and affects fisheries as well. The heating contributes to spread of tropical diseases as well. The Garnaut report, Ross Garnaut, who's doing the major report for our government, he had an interim report in February released, which I'll show you the slide later, but one of the things that they are projecting, you know, a movement of the dengue fever band, where you get dengue fever as far down as Brisbane, for relatively small temperature increases. But then rising sea levels, of course. And all these things contribute to these secondary and tertiary impacts. So we're looking at sort of large-scale movements of people, a whole bunch of things contributing to other economic costs in the middle. And that will also be leading to higher insurance costs as well. The more storms, the more frequent and severe storms, the higher insurance costs. And not just in, you know, affected coastal properties, but it pushes up premiums across the board. And the insurance industry is really worried about this. But also there's very clearly a need for greater energy efficiency and new energy sources. So that's suggesting higher energy costs. So that feeds down into a whole ton of bad things like, you know, regional conflicts, adverse health impacts, and probably tighter aid budgets. Because on the purple box on the right is a problem that our rich countries already had, which is our aging populations, which means that we've got a higher proportion of old people, like I'm going to be when this is relevant, proportionally fewer younger people paying taxes to support the health system and so on. So that was something that governments were already worried about, before all of this. We're also worried about this problem of donor fatigue. You know, people, you know, there's just too much stuff, too much doom and gloom. People, you know, just kind of get sick of hearing about it and don't want to keep giving to stuff. So that's an issue we'll have to wrestle with. But the bottom line in red is it all kind of points to more malnutrition and poverty. I should also, another dimension of this I'll just touch on very briefly, is the disinformation campaign on this whole issue has been very, very, very well documented if you're interested in the politics of all of this. I don't know if any of you remember, but in the 1990 election in Australia, the environment was one of the top issues on the agenda. And then it kind of disappeared for 10, 15 years. And one of the things going on is a very well-orchestrated campaign funded by some major corporate interests to try and make it a non-issue. And particularly on climate change, that's very well documented. But this smoke, mirrors and hot air is an analysis by the Union of Concerned Scientists in the US looking at ExxonMobil's tactics, where they basically borrowed tactics from the tobacco industry and used them in exactly the same way to try and... Their aim was not to try and disprove the science. Their aim was just to sow doubt in the public mind so that enough people would think, oh, look, the scientists disagree. I mean, how many times have you heard that? You know, the scientists disagree. It's too hard. You know, like, and let them make up their minds and come to a view, and then we can think about doing something. That was their aim. The problem is the scientists for the most part, did not disagree. You know, there's a remarkable consensus among the scientists, but they managed to give the impression that there was disagreement, so that anyone covering it in the media had to kind of give a, you know, balanced view. So you have to give, you know, the science, you know, the conventional orthodox science side, and then you had to give the skeptics side. The fact that you've got, you know, 2,000 here and 10 here, you know, it wasn't balanced. It was a very deliberate campaign. This High and Dry book is written by Guy Pearce, who was a Liberal Party staffer for many, many years and was part of Robert Hill's staff, former Environment Minister, and he basically just documents how the coal and aluminium industries effectively wrote Australia's climate change policies for the last 10 years. So we basically lost 10 years of action over this, on this issue. ExxonMobil poured about $16 million into funding a whole bunch of different think tanks and front groups, and their and others' campaigns undoubtedly influenced the politics of this and meant that we've kind of lost 10 years in concerted action. But thankfully, they are getting less and less credible. This is a photo we took in Bali from the Viscount Monckton of Brenchley, who's an advisor, Margaret Thatcher, but he's still out there. And some of them are still out there trying to basically peddle the view that, you know, it's just an international conspiracy, you know, by godless scientists who are trying to convince everyone that we're in trouble when we're not. And, you know, they're still making some noise. But thankfully, in the world has the debate shifted a lot. When do you want me to finish, Bill? Just 5 or 10 minutes. All right, I'll rush. I'll go through this quick. All right. Okay, so meanwhile, there's another issue going on, which I was appalled to come across. I guess you're all aware of oil prices and, you know, think that you know, prices have gone up a bit at the pump, but if you look at what's actually happened in the last 4 or 5 years to oil prices internationally, we have not seen, you know, oil prices have increased from about $20 a barrel to now, I think, you know, 114 or something. I saw it kind of yesterday. Now, we haven't seen that increase, that percentage increase in our petrol prices, partly because it's being absorbed by various factors, but oil prices now are at the highest level since before the beginning of the 20th century. That is also feeding into the rising cost of food, because most of the gas, most of the nitrogen fertilizer comes from natural gas, and that's linked to oil prices, of course. And the transport, 94% of the world's transport relies on oil. So the shipping, the transport, the fuel to run the machinery, the diesel, diesel generators, the diesel pumps for irrigation, the diesel trucks, all of course rely on fuel. So this is, fertilizer prices have gone up, you know, from what, $100 a ton US to $350 a ton or more recently. The food and agriculture, the World Food Programme in March put out an appeal to the world's governments because they are bleeding. They are just hemorrhaging. Their budgets are kind of awash in red ink because they've got these massive increases in food prices. They've got people they're trying to feed and they just don't have the money anymore because their food has cost so much because, you know, for various reasons. There's been droughts in Australia. There's, you know, unrest in other places. But, so it's kind of this combination of climate change and the oil prices and speculators banking on food prices going up, so they buy and hoard and lock in more expensive contracts and so on. But the bottom line is that they need $500 million to cover their immediate needs. This is what's happened to cereal prices, not Wheaties and cornflakes, but I mean, you know, rice and wheat and maize in the last few months. You can see rice has just gone through the roof in the last 2 or 3 months, and as has wheat and maize has increased significantly as well. So that's led to that very first slide I showed you, that, you know, eating dirt in Haiti, riots in a lot of countries. And what the countries that are particularly vulnerable are the ones with big urban populations, not much agricultural production, so they're very vulnerable to high food import prices. If they're also oil importers, as a lot of them are, then they're being hit in all kinds of ways by these developments. This is just showing this goes from 1920 to 2000 along the bottom line. This axis over on the left, see, it's morning, I'm not awake yet, is billions of barrels a year. And this is just showing the history of our oil discoveries compared with our production. The blue line across the bottom is production. And what is the only just take-home message from this slide is that we are year on year now consuming more oil than we discovered, and we've been doing that since about the 1980s roughly. So every year more and more and more oil being consumed and not enough being replaced or discovered. So Australian production has been doing this. We increased pretty steadily up to 2000, and then we've had a dramatic drop since then in our oil production. So we were about 100% self-sufficient roughly in 2000. Now we're only about 60% self-sufficient. By 2017, we're expected to only be about 32% self-sufficient unless we find major new oil fields. If we do find major new oil fields, that contributes more to the climate change problem. So it's kind of swings and roundabouts here. But that has big economic implications for us as well. Importing that much oil is going to be expensive, and there's suggesting a $28 billion deficit on our oil just because of that factor. Now, that's kind of the production side. On the demand side, a lot of big countries are developing strongly, like Russia, China, and parts of the Middle East are booming, and India, of course. So the International Energy Agency is still projecting that fossil fuels, which are these bottom three bands, the purple is gas, the red is oil, and the bottom is coal. They're still projecting that that fossil fuels be a major part of our energy needs. And they think that's what they're projecting for demand. And they think, well, that's manageable if we can get $22 trillion of investment in the next, by 2030. And that's about half the world's GDP annually, to give you a feel for it. Half the world's production annually is going to be needed. I don't mean each year, but so world's GDP annually is about $44-45 trillion. So they're going to need 22 over the next few years up to 2030 to manage that investment. But about $10 trillion needed in the oil and gas sector alone. That is a lot of money, and a lot of people don't think it's possible. Now, China and India are going to need most of their oil from imports because they don't have enough of their own. So this is a projection of their imports. Now, their imports are already affecting world oil prices, and they're only importing about 5 or 6 million barrels a day. They're projected to increase to at least 17, 18 million barrels a day. To be used for, well, lots of things. One is cars. They want them just like we do. The one on the right, the left, is the One Lakh mantra, the Tata conglomerate's 200,000 rupee car. The idea to bring the car to the masses of India. India's got a middle class now of roughly 300 million or so. It's enormous and growing, and China does too. And so the picture on the right, the traffic jam in Beijing. But India can't produce enough of its own oil. The green band is their domestic production, and the grey is what the International Energy Agency is expecting from Indian imports of oil. It's increasing to about 7 million barrels a day. And China's demands could look something like this. Again, green is domestic production expected, grey is expected imports, but the dark grey bar on the top is looking at an analysis that was done of what China's imports might more realistically look like if China follows a similar path to other countries. You know, if they consume about the same amount of oil that other countries do when they got to similar levels of development, China's consumption could be more like 29 million barrels a day, so quite extraordinary. Where's it going to come from? Well, the International Energy Agency is kind of betting the farm on that it's going to be able to come from the Middle East. OPEC is the Arab oil cartel with Venezuela and a couple of other South American countries. They control about 42% of the world oil now. The International Energy Agency is expecting that it'll be up to 52% by 2030. So that suggests they'll be able to push prices up more. In fact, while President Bush went to Saudi Arabia in January asking the Saudis to pump more oil, and they said, no, they can't. And actually, in the last 2 or 3 months, OPEC have cut their production back. So while the Western economies are kind of bleeding from high oil prices and the US is slipping into recession, OPEC have been quietly winding back production to make sure oil prices stay high. The problem is Saudi Arabia is a country that's kind of held together with duct tape. They've had a soaring population growth. On the left is their population compared to ours. So we're in the blue, kind of risen reasonably steadily. But they have come from behind us to now well ahead of us. They have about 23 million now, but they're expecting 33 to 39 million by 2030. They had a collapse of their standard of living in the mid-80s. So now they have a huge pool of unemployed, poorly educated young people. They've had a mutual protection alliance for the last 250 years between the House of Saud, the royal family, and the Wahhabi kind of radical cleric sect, which used to be a fairly minor sect, but now has been funded for 30 years with Saudi oil money and spread all over the world and now control the main holy cities of Mecca and Medina, and have controlled the Saudi education system for the last 30 years as well. So now you have 2 out of 3 PhDs in Saudi Arabia and Islamic studies. Most of their technical expertise has to be imported. Most of their technical staff are foreigners. They have a royal family with about 10,000 princes and princesses living off the public purse. A lot of the general population hate the royal family with a passion and would like to get rid of them. There's not a clear line of succession with the Saudi royal family. When the king dies, there's always a little bit of manoeuvring. And they're sitting on about 25% of the world's oil reserves. This is a BBC report from March. The situation the royal family realises is so delicate that they are wanting to retrain all 40,000 of their clerics. You can imagine the situation would be analogous to, if our government decided, look, all of it, we've got way too many priests and ministers and vicars who are preaching hatred and wanting to overthrow the government. So we need to send all of our clergy back to Bible College to try to get them to not do that anymore. That's the situation the Saudis are facing. Now, these are two visions of possible global oil production. The coloured chart with the downward depressing slope is from a German group called Energy Watch. That's their assessment of what global oil production is likely to do in the next few years. So actually reach a peak and then a fairly dramatic decline. The WEO is the World Energy Outlook, the International Energy Agency. That's their projection, which is a much more kind of Pollyanna-ish optimistic view. So we've kind of got this wedge of uncertainty in the middle, and the fate of the world economy basically hangs on where reality lies between those two views. And the challenge is that no one is entirely sure really what's closer to the truth. But the International Energy Agency is much less Pollyanna-ish than they were even a couple of years ago. These are some testaments from them. Top line saying, in their latest report that came out in November, saying a supply-side crunch after 2015 with an abrupt escalation in oil prices can't be ruled out. Their chief economist in November said in an interview to Time magazine, "Sorry to say this, but we're headed for really bad days. Lots of targets have been set, but very little has been done." It's all very well to say the oil's there, but if the investment's not happening, if production delays, costs are going up, then it's not going to work. A report done for the US Department of Energy says that, we've never faced a problem like this. And without massive mitigation and planning more than a decade in advance, the problem will be pervasive and won't be temporary. So previous oil transitions were fairly gradual and evolutionary. This one will be abrupt and revolutionary unless we actually prepare for it. There's been two Australian government inquiries. Queensland one, federal government one, basically said, look, this is a really important issue and we want a couple of government agencies to go away and look at it more carefully. So they sort of hedged their bets a bit. But the Queensland government one said they concluded that the overwhelming evidence was that world oil production would peak within the next 10 years. The CEO of Shell sent an email to all Shell's 100,000 staff in January this year, basically saying that Shell estimates that after 2015, supplies of easy to access oil won't any longer keep up with demand. Now, there's also not easy to access oil, which is more expensive and harder and so on. But what they're basically saying is that oil prices aren't going to come down substantially for any great period of time. Mineral prices may come down over the next 2 or 3 years. I'm not suggesting that the trajectory is always onward and upward. They may come down a bit, but the overall thrust of global developments, you know, China and India and all the rest of it, are that supply is unlikely to be able to keep up with the demand, so it suggests higher prices. In Africa, the cost of oil have effectively wiped out their gains they've had from debt relief and aid over the last 3 years. They're just having to pay so much for extra for the oil and food and all the rest of it. One of the implications for us, as we thought through this issue of World Vision, is that it means, you know, the oil that's wasted by countries like Australia in the OECD, it's a club of rich countries, it pushes up the price of oil. So when we buy, every contribution we make, when we fill up our tanks, that is part of the demand for oil. It helps keep the price up. So the more we consume, the higher the price is. So the oil that's consumed by our rich countries is oil, firstly, that the poor countries can't use, because we've burnt it, and secondly, it makes it more expensive. So we've realised that energy policies in Australia, in the US and Europe matter for World Vision and, you know, development agencies in a way that we didn't really think they would, even a couple of years ago. An early peak of oil has enormous implications for developing countries. It escalates their oil import prices, gives them economic problems, escalates food prices. Their transport, agriculture systems are vulnerable and suggests possible economic downturns as well. What's next? Well, it depends when a peak may occur, how soon it might be, whether there's an actual plateau, whether there's a real decline, how the financial markets respond, how the exporting countries respond as well, like whether they decide to hoard it and use it mainly for domestic consumption. Like, I think in Venezuela, they subsidise oil to the masses so that you fill up, I guess, about 2 cents a litre or something in Venezuela. And that's part of the reason the government stays in power. But also, I think, my view is we're likely to see substantial increases in oil prices and increased volatility. But as I said, the price may go down before that happens. But the long-term trajectory, I think, is up. Now, if it was up and everyone knew it was going to up and be up and stay there, then you can kind of plan and adjust to that. But what is more likely is it'll go up and then come down and then go up and come down. People think, oh, finally it's coming down again. But then it goes up again. And that makes investment much more tricky and much harder, and planning much harder when you've got high volatility as well. But also likely to see increased power of OPEC, especially Saudi Arabia, Iran, Venezuela, and also Russia, which is becoming it's flexing its muscles again, let's put it that way, after the humiliations of the early 1990s, and wants to be taken seriously again. How will the US and China react? Well, they are both major oil importers, both having to react and adjust to climate change as well. So how are they going to react to this? We're already seeing a new scramble for oil in Africa. All companies are piling into Africa, trying to buy oil leases and exploring there. It also has very serious implications for our mitigation, adaptation to climate change. So, as much, we had enough trouble getting decent climate change policy when our economy was booming, last year. And we had years and years and years of boom, and we still couldn't get decent policy. It's probably going to be harder when our economies are under stress from oil prices as well. Okay, so let's shift a gear. What are some of the theological reflections to draw out? Well, one I think is stewards of God's earth, not its owners. There's no presumption in Scripture that we are the owners of this world. This world is God's, and we are put here as stewards. We don't have any right to despoil the earth or cause the extinction of other species. I think God does care if species extinctions are our fault. I think we also will be called to account for our treatment of the earth, as well as our treatment of the poor and the oppressed. And one of the historical realities is that Australia and the other rich countries have basically, we didn't know we were doing it, but we have done it. We unjustly appropriated a much bigger fair share of the atmosphere's capacities than it can cope with. Developing countries now are very resentful that we are basically saying to them, look, we know we have developed and we know we've poured tons and tons of gunk into the atmosphere. It's actually caused a bit of a problem. So can you please not do it? You know, they are quite rightly furious about this situation. And so to have them, get them on board means that we need to be generous to them with our, you know, with our money, our aid, and our technology transfer. And, we have to take seriously their concern about the injustice of the situation. But also, I think, you know, we have been blessed with an abundance unimaginable to our forebears. You know, those of you who've been around, you know, longer than I have, you know, will know the changes and the increase in standards of living in Australia. And when the fate of the world, the planet, is at stake, I think it is not too hard an ask that we maybe need called on to make some sacrifices. This is just a verse some of you may not have come across. The Bible makes very clear that it's not just those who are poor, oppress the poor, that will be judged, but also those who despoil the earth. This is just the verse from Revelation. It says, then the 24 elders who sit on their thrones before God fell on their faces and worshipped God, saying, we give you thanks, Lord God Almighty, who are and who were, for you have taken your great power and begun to reign. The nation is raised, but your wrath has come, and the time for judging the dead, for rewarding your servants, the prophets, the saints, and all who fear your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroy the earth. It's not just about us. It's about the whole of creation, God redeeming the whole of creation. God is concerned about his creation. God also cares deeply about children and any barriers that may be put in their way of them coming to love him. So the verse from Mark, you know, if any of you put a stumbling block before one of these little ones who believe in me, it would be better for you if a great millstone were hung around your neck and you were thrown into the sea. So we, our generation, we inherited something close to Eden. You know, what are we going to be leaving to our children and our grandchildren and their children? Are they going to see the glory of God in creation, or are they going to find creation something oppressive because of what we've done to it? This is why I'm here. This is why I'm doing this. I mean, I appreciate the crumpets and the cup of tea, but I'm doing this because they're my daughters, Jessica on the right and Annabelle on the left. We look at this through a child rights lens. Children have the right to protection, the right to survival, the right to food, the right to water, the right to health, the right to hope as well. I don't want to talk to my daughters about this stuff. I don't want their generation to have to deal with it, and their generation should not have to deal with it, because we've been too lazy and complacent and stupid to do anything about it ourselves. If we've just allowed our political masters to get away with half-hearted measures, it's our children and our grandchildren who are going to have to deal with them after we're gone. The implications for climate change of the National Energy Agency's projections are horrific. The top line is the trajectory we're on, which basically sends us up to 5 or 6 degrees warming, which essentially, yeah, sends us to hell in a way. The bottom, the middle line is the policies that are on the table that may be able to bring it down to 3 degrees. The bottom line is actually where we need to go to bring it much closer to 2 degrees warming. I'll give crime rushers quick. This is just to show you some of the charts that are drawn up to show what are the changes in different temperature gradients. What does it mean if we get to 1 degree or 2 degrees or 3 degrees or 4 degrees or 5 degrees? They don't even bother going to 6 degrees because it's just so far out of human experience. This is the bottom line. The bottom brown band from the Garneau report just says, you know, we don't really consider this because it's so far out of human experience. We don't know what's going to happen. But it's a whole bunch of bad things before we even get anywhere near that. The projections for 3 degrees are increasing droughts, tens of millions exposed to water stress, up to 30% species at risk of extinction, lower crop productivity, increased damage from floods and storms, millions from coastal flooding, and increased mortality from a whole bunch of diseases and so on. For 5 degrees, which is the trajectory we're currently on, chronic droughts, hundreds of millions without enough water, significant species extinctions, lower food productivity, hundreds of millions experiencing coastal flooding. But the bottom one is the potential trigger irreversible melting of the two of the major ice sheets and potential collapse of the Atlantic current system, which basically keeps Europe having a climate that is warmer than Siberia because it's on roughly the same latitudes. Now, those ice sheets wouldn't undergo a complete collapse next century or later this century. It'll take a while. But the thing with the climate system is that we can cross the threshold where it becomes inevitable and there's nothing we can do about it. We can cross that threshold well before we actually see the results on the ground. Nick Stern, who is the British government, who was appointed by the British government to do an overall assessment for climate change last year, 2006, his report came out. It was pretty well received. It was attacked by economists for being too alarmist and so on. But he's basically saying, this is from a couple of days ago, 3 days ago, in Financial Times, saying, we underestimated the risks, we underestimated the damage associated with temperature increases, we underestimated the probability of temperature increases. The damage risks are far bigger than I would have argued. Things like the damage associated with 5-degree temperature increase are enormous. So he's basically saying, look, I was right about how little it would cost to actually deal with the problem, but I grossly underestimated how serious the problem was. What's needed is that for the rich countries like Australia to reduce our emissions by between 25-40% below our 1990 levels by 2020 and more than 80% below 1990 levels by 2050. This is something we have to do. And we've just got to work out how to do it. And there are ways. I'm not going to go into them, but there are ways of doing it. I'll skip that. No, I won't. I'll just say one thing. When they look at that and say, isn't it going to cause absolute chaos in the economy? No, it wouldn't. No, it wouldn't at all. The bottom line from this chart is the very bottom line, where it says, essentially, to address this issue, even if it costs, if our GDP was 5.5% or 6% lower by 2050, what that means, basically, is that we shave less than 0.2 percentage points off our annual growth each year. So we'd still be growing, and we'd probably have to wait till 2052 to be as rich as we would have been in 2050. It's not a big deal economically. It will involve significant changes and redirections and so on, but it's not economic catastrophe to actually deal with this problem. Almost done. So some of the no regrets actions, choosing, I guess, more localised lifestyles, some of the choices we make about where we live, where we commute to and so on, reducing some of that unnecessary travel and offsetting where possible. Most of the airlines allow you to offset flights so you can offset the carbon emissions. Also buying more efficient cars, appliances, lights, etc. We need big improvements in building design, town planning and so on. And greatly increased investment in energy efficiency, especially oil efficiency. I mean, these two issues, the oil and energy issue and the climate change issue, both point in one direction, which is we need massive improvements in energy efficiency and we need to start doing it now. Related to that, our public transport is dreadful. We need much, as many of you know, we need to improve that. And also agriculture that is less reliant on fossil fuel imports. So we're pretty vulnerable as well. If we're going to be importing most of our oil and fossil fuel imports, our agriculture relies still overwhelmingly on that. And that is going to hit us with food prices and food availability as well. So that's it. These are questions we have. We were going to break into groups. It's a lot all at once, especially in the morning. I do apologise. But, some questions for our groups. What does it mean for our children? How will the fall be affected? What will we do? What will we change in our own lives? And what can we do as a church community? So.